Good morning. On Thursday evening, the news came through of the sudden death of Marion Finucane.
Hello, a very good afternoon to you, and welcome to another edition of Women Today. So now, straight into today's programme, which is part one of a two-part programme on sex education. This is an area which, if neglected, seems to cause terrible problems in later life, sadness, confusion, frustration, and indeed a lot of unhappiness. GPs, priests and social workers.
Hello there, and a very good morning to you. He is the chair of Anglo-Irish Bank. He was CEO of Anglo for about 22 years. First of all, you're very welcome indeed, Sean Fitzpatrick.
Thank you, Marion. I mean, we're in the business of making money. We're business people. And what we want to do is, we don't want to be reckless. We want to make money. In fact, you know, if I had been sitting here with you 2 years ago, you would have been saying, look at all you guys, you're making all this money. I mean, now we're just turning around and sort of saying you've been reckless and you're not going to make money.
Well, the reason we're concerned about whether or not you've been reckless is that we're signing the guarantee.
Absolutely.
So we have a vested interest now in ways that we, and by we, I mean all the listeners, had never had before. Another one says, now that the banker has said thanks, can he go the whole hog and say sorry to the Irish people?
Well, Marion, you know, it'd be very easy for me to answer, you know, a call like that and say sorry. What I've got to say is this, is that the cause of our problems was global, not directed, nothing. So I can't say sorry with any type of sincerity and decency. But I do say a very genuine thank you.
Would you welcome, please, our second celebrity guest on tonight's Quicksilver. She's a lady you would know as a broadcaster. Her professional training was as an architect. Many people would say she was one of the architects of the downfall of male superiority. Would you welcome, please, Marion Finucane.
Trailblazer and pioneer, a fair and empathetic listener with incisive intelligence. As that montage from Morning Ireland demonstrated, Marion Finucane had the ability to draw out a guest and elicit the most revealing of interviews. On Drive Time, just after the news of her death had broken, Philip Boucher-Hayes spoke to contributor and friend Maureen Gaffney.
I don't know how many times I would have listened to yourself and Marion exchanging wisdoms and thoughts. What are your thoughts this evening?
I'm not actually sure that I could, that thoughts even are the predominant thing that's going on. I mean, I'm shocked to the core of my being. Really, really shocked. I can't conceive of life without Marion. I really liked her in a personal way. I've known her and her husband, John, for a long time. I always loved doing the programs with Marion, but it's the cumulative loss of someone of Marion's extraordinary talent the same year as we've lost Gay Byrne. And they shared so much of a really unique style of broadcasting that I think is very Irish. They were absolutely attuned to the changes that were going on, just enough ahead of them to be able to, as it were, stay in real emotional touch with the ordinary person, but yet sort of enough ahead to keep moving things forward. And like Gay, she had that sort of great ability to be very genial and seeming like she's letting someone sort of go on, and then suddenly they pounce, you know. I've heard her so often do it on the Sunday morning shows, and she just was, she's really quite irreplaceable.
Maureen Gaffney on Drive Time. Yesterday, former President Mary Robinson spoke on Morning Ireland about Marion Finucane's role in helping change Irish society and the role of women in particular. Rachel English asked about her work on Women Today and also a documentary, Abortion, The Lonely Crisis.
Back in those years, I think it was in 1979, she also made a documentary in which she accompanied a woman who was going to England for an abortion. It must have been so unusual at that time to hear this being discussed on national radio.
Absolutely unusual, unprecedented, and I don't think people actually wanted to hear it. You know, it wasn't something that was repeated or, you know, it was only more recently that women felt that they could tell those stories. And it was very important leading up to the recent referendum that women were heard for the first time properly and in numbers and educated us to what it was like to have to go abroad for a termination of pregnancy. So it was a very, very courageous thing to do. And that was Marion. She had that capacity.
How important was her role over the years, do you think, and how will she be remembered?
I think it was extremely important because she was a trailblazer, because she was brave, because she was honest, because she opened up issues in a way that was really important. And, you know, she's remembered rightly for work on women's issues, but she went far beyond that to broader issues. She always, you know, kind of moved agendas. And Women Today was a very significant move to allow women to present, women to, you know, be producers and presenters on a radio programme. That was new to RTE, as I understand it, and, you know, really significant. And she just went on blazing the trail with that honesty, with that integrity, with that fearlessness at times. She wasn't afraid of church or state.
Mary Robinson on Morning Ireland. Of course, one of her standout interviews took place in September 2001 in the wake of the 9/11 attacks in America. And she took Junior Minister Joe Jacobs to task about the state's preparedness for a nuclear strike. And iodine tablets were to be our saviour, it seemed.
Minister, here we are. We're heading now for, we're 15 and a half minutes in. How do I get my iodine tablets? It's written on that fact sheet. Yes, tell me.
Yes, you'll get them from the Department of Health and Children, and they will be maintaining stocks of these iodine tablets for this purpose. And
how do I get them?
The specific, as soon as as you need them, the excellent communication process that you and I talked about a few moments ago clicks into gear, and that will say exactly how that is to be done.
I've taken shelter.
You've taken shelter.
I'm in my house. I've sealed the windows.
Right.
How do I get my iodine tablet?
You will be told that when we're in emergency. We were not in emergency situation. And as I said, that is one of the finer points that we wanted to deal with, the actual mechanics of doing that. And perhaps
what does it say in the fact sheet?
What it says in the fact sheets are that arrangements are being made for the I'll tell you precisely what it's saying at now, and this will be more explicit when it goes out. The draft I'm reading at the moment, as you asked the question, from the National Emergency Plan for Nuclear Accidents fact sheet.
It's 17 minutes past. Where do I get my iodine
tablet? You will get your iodine tablet. You may have it in your home when we decide that.
Right.
Or you may have, there may be distribution centres around the country organised by the Department of Health and Children, whose responsibility it will be, A, to maintain stocks of them and to provide them via distribution centres. Or perhaps we're considering having a file in every home with the fact sheet that you and I are discussing now.
Minister, can I just put an overall question
yes.
to you? Do you feel confident that if something dreadful did happen, which it hasn't happened and won't happen, listeners, we hope, in Sellafield, do you feel confident that the proper preparations have been made to protect the citizens?
Marion, can I say this to you with the greatest certitude? I feel as confident after putting 2 years' work...
Ooh, intelligence and wit in spades. On Thursday's Drive Time, Joe Duffy spoke about Marion Finucane's fairness and her impartiality.
Be it a priest, a prime minister, a politician, or a local organiser, or just an ordinary citizen phoning in with their story, they knew they'd get a fair hearing from Marion, because she'd ask everything we'd all want to ask before we'd make our mind up. I still defy calling anyone to identify Marion Finucane's party politics. I don't think they'd know them. We know she was brilliant. But my main sense of Marion, listening to her as I did every single day and then on Liveline and then when she's did the morning show after Gay retired, and then on the weekends was that she was the voice of reason. You always knew you'd get a reasoned argument, a reasoned interrogation, and she had that brilliant, brilliant skill of, in a very calm, reasoned, incredulous way at times, getting the truth or the story out of somebody. But it's a terrible loss of a great, great, great person.
And it was that fairness that had made her such a trusted broadcaster, a trait which was vital to her role on Liveline.
They knew they would get a fair hearing from Marion. They knew no matter where they stood or what they were saying, or indeed a lot of people ringing with their own stories. But even when it got into arguments, and remember, Marion steered in terms of the national public discourse, now along with others, but she steered us through the amendment campaign, the abortion campaign, the marriage equality referendum, all those incredible social changes that transformed Ireland in the last 20 years. But the reason she did it was that people knew they would get a fair hearing from her, that she was the voice of reason, that she would be calm on both sides and she would treat both sides equally regardless of the strength or so-called background or pedigree or experience or education or whatever of either party.
Joe Duffy as heard on Thursday's Drive Time. And yesterday, callers phoned in to Katie Hannan to give their memories of Marion at the helm of Liveline. Here's Myra.
It was 20 years ago. I was expecting my last child and I had a blowout on the motorway coming up from Wexford, and I limped into a garage in Bray, and the young lad behind the counter was going to help me change the tyre because I was very obviously pregnant. I was about 7 months pregnant. And the manager came out and stopped him from helping me. So when I rang in, straight away she got what I was talking about and helped me then to articulate it.
And Liveline had a clip from 1998 as to how Marion had handled it all.
I just couldn't believe that this was the attitude, and it wasn't the Four Courts attendant's fault. It was this guy, the manager.
Who happens to be on the other line. Martin, good afternoon to you. Martin,
hello,
you're the manager in this particular garage. Why wouldn't you let them change your wheel?
Well, first of all, I'd like to apologise to the lady. It's not right that she should have not got good service at the station and that she was left like that. But unfortunately, Marion, the society we live in, we're not insured to change wheels or to change tyres. We're a petrol station shop. We don't do any servicing or repairs to cars, and we don't carry insurance for it. And that's the reason for it, that it's just a society we live in. We can't take that chance.
And why didn't you tell her yourself?
I wasn't talking to her. I was in the office, and the lads, they know or they should know, they're not covered by insurance to change wheels.
Well, can I ask you, Martin?
Yeah.
I mean, you've said you apologise, and fair enough. But if Myra pulled in there tonight, what would you do?
Oh, there was no messing with Marion. But this is how Myra remembers the call.
She picked up straight away what it was. She was so good at picking out What was the nitty gritty of the story was that somebody was refusing to help another human being, and it this the way the world was going, and she did it with such ease and such grace. I mean, she was a pleasure to talk to at any time or listen to, and she'd be so sorely missed because she was so good at it.
Liveline on Friday. But it is perhaps her interview with her friend, the writer, Nuala O'Fuaillon, for which Marion Finucane will be best remembered.
The certainty we all have in this life is that we will die, that either we will die or those that we love will. Dealing with dying ourselves, our loved ones, our members of the family, is rarely talked about and rarely talked to with the terminally ill person. So that in turn means that the terminally ill person very often can be isolated as they protect others. Nuala was diagnosed recently with a terminal illness, and what you will hear from her is one person's experience, her experience of facing death. It's honest what you're going to hear, and it's stark. For anyone listening who is terminally ill now or who has a relative dealing with this, you could find this hard. When were you diagnosed?
about 6 weeks ago. Everything was well, but I was walking along one day after fitness class and my right side began to drag. And I eventually went to A&E in a New York hospital. The guy came past and said, oh, your CAT scans show you've got two brain tumours and we're going to do x-rays to see where they're from. They're not primaries. And that's the first ever I knew.
He said that to you in the middle of A&E?
Yeah, he just passed by. And I was on my own, you know.
How did you deal with the information?
I couldn't deal with it. I was so shocked that I would pay attention to anything except what I'd just been told.
And in terms of, because the first thing that people, when they hear about cancer, is the shock, the terror, and the treatment, did they say to you, or did you even ask them at that stage about the treatment and your chances and those kinds of questions?
I came back to Ireland and did 14 brain radiations, and the idea was that I would move on to chemotherapy. Whether it's the disease or the brain radiation, I don't know or care, reduced me to such feelings of impotence and wretchedness and sourness with life that and fear that I decided against.
A truly extraordinary interview. Nuala O'Fuilleann talking to her friend, Marion Finucane. Welcome back. Former US Ambassador to the United Nations and Pulitzer Prize winning author Samantha Power was the guest on Second Captain's New Year's Eve special. And when her mother moved the family to Pittsburgh, it was one particular ball sport that helped her get used to her new home.
Baseball in particular, because right when I arrived, the local team, the Pittsburgh Pirates, were making this run. It would end up culminating in the World Series where they won the championship. And it was just the talk of the town. And so when you're looking around, you just want to fit in. My way of fitting in was to learn the rules. And then more than that, to try to make myself an actual expert.
I saw in a New Yorker profile of you a few years ago, Power became American through baseball. That sounds almost a bit schmaltzy, but is it true?
I think so. I mean, at least I came to feel American. I don't know that I, you know, how deep it went, but I definitely was capable of trading baseball cards in the neighborhood. You know, I learned the history. One of the things when you watch professionals on TV in American baseball, especially in those days, they had these big wads of tobacco, like with their cheeks bulging out. And then there was this chewing gum called Big League Chew, you know, and we kids, we would put the Big League Chew, the chewing gum, in our cheek, and it would bulge out as if it was tobacco. And so my mother's like, oh my God, like sport is one thing, but rotting teeth on behalf of looking like your sports idol,
at
maybe not so much.
9 years of age or whatever.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Now, it being second captain, sport is sometimes by the by. It was when Samantha Power talked about her father's drinking and her parents' separation that you really got an insight into her life. Her mother had moved the family to America with the agreement that Samantha and her brother would stay with her father in Ireland during holiday periods. But one Christmas, he was determined to keep the children in Ireland in violation of their separation agreement.
I think we were watching The Sound of Music or The Wizard of Oz, like on this black and white TV with the antenna, you know, kind of taped and what up. And pulling Christmas crackers. And then there's a knock at the door very late at night, probably 11 o'clock at night. And it was my mother. And she basically said, come now, you know, in a very stern voice, which I didn't hear much from her as a kid. And my brother, just as his mother, goes running to her. He is five at the time and just kind of nestles next to her in the kind of driveway or the path to the house. And I'm paralyzed because here's this moment, the two people I love more than any people in the world and who I trust, and I've seen them fight, of course, and argue, but this is whoa, what does one do? And so I take a step kind of toward my mother, and then my dad says, no, don't go, and I'm just there between, you know, stuck in this kind of horrible Hobson's choice. And ultimately, my mother's more forceful. My dad probably knew deep down that he wanted to make a good showing, and he desperately would have loved to have gotten sorted to be in a position to take care of us, but to be the full-time parent to two kids, given his drinking, and maybe he knew deep down. So he sort of wasn't as forceful and authoritative in that moment as my mother was, and so I ran to my mother, got in the car, and then we, you know, within a day had kind of hightailed it to the airport and you know, flown back to America, cutting short this trip and this visit with my father, which would have been dramatic under any circumstances. But then she laid down the law, like, since he did what he did and was trying to effectively, you know, keep us and violate the custody arrangement, he should come to America. He should give a showing of being capable of at least doing that. And again, seemed to me like a manageable task, right? We had flown back and forth now at least twice, and he could do it, but he never could get organized.
So you never saw him again. That was the last.
Her father was to die at the age of 47, and Samantha Power described the lasting impact of that particular moment on her life and her outlook.
I did. I felt responsible. I went back over that scene on the footpath where I was choosing between my mother and my father, and really, and others reinforced this for me when I was a kid, but the idea that had I made a different choice somehow, I mean, it's crazy, right?
Yeah.
I was 9 years old. There was no different choice really available to me, but it's not atypical for children to take on superpowers for themselves, you know, as if, and also a sense of if I had been worth it, somehow my dad would have given up the drink. And so, you know, some sort of latent self-esteem issues that grow from not understanding what a disease addiction is. And so later coming to understand it cognitively, but still not necessarily being able to forgive myself. And so I do. I spend a fair amount of time in the book talking about therapy and, like, trying to dig into it and trying to just accept that there's certain things that you can take responsibility for that are within your power to control, and to some extent you have to surrender that sense of agency, especially when you're a child. And now one of the things that's helped me, I think, over my life is having children of my own, and just my son is 10 now, Declan, and, you know, I just think, what was I thinking? You know, I mean, how could this little person have had the kinds of effects that I regretted not having had when I was a kid?
Samantha Power, as heard on Second Captains, and for the record, she's also quite the sportswoman. 10 years is a pretty long time, but in the world of social media, it's a lifetime. On Monday's Morning Ireland, Jackie Fox spoke to Tanya Locott, Professor of Social Media Communications at DCU, Sinead O'Carroll, editor at The Journal, and Orla Condon, host of the podcast My Pod on Paper, about the rise and rise of social media, and just how exactly had Twitter become the medium of choice for sitting presidents.
You look back at Twitter back in 2010, say at the start of this decade, there's something quite quaint about it. Like, people will probably remember, like, tweet-ups, like, people meet, I think that's what they were called, tweet-ups. You would meet people who you had met through Twitter. Imagine doing that now, like, you'd need an armed guard with you or something. Like, so, but it was a place that people actually enjoyed talking to each other, and it wasn't probably quite the echo chamber. You would actually have interesting discussions and then want to actually meet these people in real life. So the evolution of Twitter, I think, in the 10 years is probably one of the most fascinating aspects of social media.
Ain't that the truth, sister? But what about social media's potential for increased political engagement?
It seems that, you know, new generations are being brought in to news stories that they might have never heard about before. We had those protests in Sudan against a leader who was in power for decades, and we saw icons of young teenagers, celebrities turning blue in solidarity with that movement. Can you see the younger generation and the new generation getting more engaged in politics and understanding those protest movements from what they hear on social media and see as well?
Yeah, I mean, like, here in Ireland, the repeal and the Eighth Amendment, that was our social organisation where we were sharing our messages on there. I mean, that was a social movement, and you saw it through that whole, like, all that year and leading up to the referendum in May. Like, you saw the momentum building, and for a lot of people down the country, I mean, myself at the time, I was at home in Cork for a lot of it. You're not in Dublin city centre where the protests are happening and there's marches and all this kind of stuff, but you're connected because you're at home, you're watching the live stream, you're tweeting in, you're a part of the live stream on Instagram, you're whatever, you're adding to this voice online. So definitely there's a feeling that, maybe it's naive, but you feel like you're contributing and you're being heard, even though there's so many of you screaming about the same thing.
I think in Western style democracies, one of the things that organisers of political campaigns or candidates have to be really careful that what they're doing online is moved into the real life sphere. Like, look at Labour in the UK election, their popularity seemed to be really growing in those last few days before the UK went to the polls. And it was a complete figment of social media. Like, I was even tweeting about Little Mix. The girl band were trying to get people, their fans, out to vote Labour. And there was a real, like, kind of momentum behind some of the tweets. And I thought it was really interesting. Young people saying, I've looked it up and I've read the Labour manifesto and it's really interesting and I'm going to go vote. So when you're reading that, you are thinking that narrative of younger people are getting interest in politics. You know, there's a big vote out there. And, you know, there was a big Labour vote, but it didn't change the narrative of the election whatsoever.
Ooh, don't believe all your tweet. That was Monday's Morning Ireland. And later that same morning, Damien O'Reilly spoke to Niamh Lyons about the upcoming general election here and the importance of social media to that election for Taoiseach, or rather, social.
A lot of this is going to be fought on social. A lot of people are going to be targeted directly through the type of issues that matter to them on Facebook. And I mean, it'll have to be done better than the twee stuff we see from politicians and the kind of cringeworthy stuff on Snapchat and TikTok and whatever. But they're going to be able to use data. They're certainly going to spend a lot of money advertising in that way and campaigning in that way. And that's somewhere where the Taoiseach is very comfortable. I mean, we see that from the type of publicity he likes, which is his Christmas Day swim with his partner. You know, they are the type of headlines that he's into. But I suppose in terms of how he manages to appear less corporate, because that was a huge issue in the 2016 general election. You know, Fine Gael used the optics of we are in government, we are in control, but it was seen as being a bit distant. And they did have a big win during the Fine Gael leadership campaign. That was a kind of a more folksy sort of setup. They were going from place to place on almost kind of, you know, a kind of a church hall type setting. And there was a lot of interaction with voters. So there's some talk that perhaps they'll use a little bit of that to inject a bit of life, I suppose, back in.
Ooh, because you can never have too many Insta stories of Leo being groovy and Michal hanging in the hood. That was Niamh Lyons with Damien O'Reilly on Monday. Sure, it's all ahead of us. On Tuesday, Catherine Thomas spoke to Cara Augustenberg, Senior Fellow in Environment Policy at UCD, about what the future might hold for the planet. Brace yourself.
What will the news reports and the news bulletins be saying about climate change in 5 years' time, in your opinion?
I mean, it's not going to get better, unfortunately. Even if we act now, it takes a long time to turn the boat around. The planet takes a while to respond to our actions. So there's almost like a 30-year delay. And you see that with the ozone layer. When we banned CFCs, it took about 30 years for the Earth to respond and for the ozone layer to start to close. So our actions today are not going to really change anything over the next 5-10 years. So it's more extreme weather to come. And even in the UK, the Climate Advisory Council just wrote a letter to the new government saying the UK is not at all prepared for what's coming down the pipeline with respect to extreme weather. And Ireland is not prepared either. So we need to be talking about sea level rise, planned retreat, flooding, you know, all sorts of extreme weather issues, food security, energy security. All of these things are going to become issues in Ireland in the next 10 years. And they're the issues that keep me up at night, really.
Mm. And of course, all of this was taking place against the backdrop of fires that are raging in Australia. Local community radio presenter in Victoria, Don Ashby, spoke later that day on the news.
The bush has never burnt like this before, ever. There's never been so many bushfires all at once, burning indiscriminately across the landscape. We are a real ecological catastrophe, firmly in the arms of global warming. Our country is so unbelievably dry. We expect these fires to burn until Easter and then only stop if we get some decent rain.
From the news bulletin on Tuesday. On New Year's Day, Arena looked forward to the cultural calendar for 2020, the books, gigs and exhibitions you just must see. And for Kate Brennan Harding, it's a small festival called Another Love Story. Now, the conversation seemed to be suitably artsy until fellow contributor Sinead Gleeson chipped in.
Isn't there a snog shack or something?
It's a shift shack.
I went the previous year, and it's the smallness of it is what makes it really special. Completely. It's not like any other festival.
Only 1,000 people there, so yeah, you don't want to be going to the shift shack too often.
Well, you see, you'd know everyone there.
See, the shift shack, right? So, for example, the shift shack would be the size of the studio. It is a derelict building, outbuilding, and there'd be two DJs in there.
This is a very small studio now.
It's incredible. Yes, exactly.
So it's a small outbuilding.
So I'm, what, 5'3", and I go into the shift shack at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm bounced in and carried in bouncing by everybody else's body. My feet were not touching the ground for a good 45 minutes.
Oh, so the shift shack is full of people.
It's a sardine shack, yes, exactly, of smiling, happy, glitter-filled people who are just coming in.
Lights on or off?
Off, but like with some disco balls, do you know? But there's art installations in the woods. It's just, it's an absolute sensation.
Yeah, no, go back to the shift chat. Never mind.
Arena. Back after this. Welcome back. Now, perhaps it was the time of year, the crisscrossing of the country to visit the relatives and the ebb and flow of nationalities at airports and ferry terminals. But movement, migration and a place to call home was a strand running through much of the week's radio. Brenda Donoghue turned her microphone to an unlikely pit stop for her documentary, Services Ahead. It was the Barack Obama Plaza in Moneygall, County Offaly. This is Maria, who works in the bakery.
What age were you when you came to Ireland?
About 50.
50?
Yeah.
What age are you now?
But do you think if I am here 13 years ago?
No way.
It's no nice to ask a woman in the radio what age is she.
Well, I can tell you, you don't look that age.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. At 50 you decided to up sticks. And that's a big decision to make.
Yes, that wasn't a small decision, I won't deny, but that's me.
What were you leaving behind?
Family, yes. I think my daughter, my granddaughters, my grandson, my mother, they are in Hungary. My mother is in Serbia.
So you've a daughter back in Hungary?
Yes.
And grandchildren?
And grandchildren. Three girls and one son, so.
I just think that it is a very big decision to change your life, leave your child. Was that very difficult?
No, it wasn't easy, but I decided to do it because I didn't see any other choice how to make myself a money that I can help them too and myself too.
And the stories of tangos across the global dance floor continued when Brenda sat down with Helen Gannon from Limerick, but now living in St. Louis, Missouri, where she teaches Irish dancing.
Went out there in 1967 for a year with my husband, who was a physician. And we had a three-year-old son, one on the way, four suitcases and $50. And I'm 55 years there now.
Now, Helen describes herself as a happy American citizen, but she loves Ireland. However, there's a tension between her idea of home and the reality.
You know, when you come into a place like this, which feels American, but I remember resenting it. I wanted it the way it was. And I remember my mother being so appreciative of the mall and the Obama centers. And I thought, why isn't it the way I left it? But I realized that you're entitled to the same luxuries that we have in America. But there's a lot of lessons to be learned from emigration. A lot of lessons. Like, don't forget where you came from. You know, don't try to become a different person. The one thing in my life that ended up being special to me was my Irish dancing. I had two masters, and yet I ended up teaching Irish dancing. I was a nurse midwife in Galway, and that was useless to me in America, but I could do the jig. So I ended up wanting my children to learn a bit of music, so they all played the fiddle, and then the kids would come into the house and we'd teach them the jig.
Are you fully immersed in American life and the politics of America?
I am.
And is this your sister saying yes?
And we don't agree on the politics, Brenda.
Not at all.
No. Yeah. And Anne comes out to help me with my fish in February. But we don't talk about politics because neither one of us agree.
Silence
on that.
From Services Ahead with Brenda Donoghue, an absolute cracker of a programme.
The thing that's special about Iceland and the Faroe Islands, of course, is that there was nobody here except for a few slightly lost, puzzled hermits who were enjoying themselves in peace until the Vikings started coming along.
Mother's Blood, Sister Songs, the lyric feature on Sunday with composer Linda Buckley exploring the genetic connections between Ireland and Iceland.
My name's Terry Gunnell, I'm Professor of Folkloristics at University of Iceland.
And why do you think it's important for us to tell our stories upon arriving to a new land? Is it a sense of mapping ourselves onto the landscape?
Yeah, this was a land which had no maps, it had nothing. The people coming here had never encountered anything of that kind. When you're coming here, first of all, you have, where do you bury your dead? At home, you've got graveyards which have been going from the Bronze Age. At home, you know where the hidden people live, the spirits of the land live. When you come here, where do you go? Where do the dead go? What language do you use with this land? It smells different, it bubbles differently to the land at home. So it's a pretty frightening space. And I find what's particularly interesting here is that you've got to create sacredness, sacred spaces, a little bit like the places on the farm you don't touch, that you maybe leave things out for the spirits. So yes, definitely, but you're coming here, you're mapping out the landscape, and one way of mapping out a landscape is by telling stories about it.
And it is how the landscape shapes the way we live and our need to carve meaning into the land itself that interests him.
I talk about legends that are sort of implicit legends, that somebody says, oh, and that's that place over there, it's an enchanted spot. And you say, why? Hart er í heimi, hordómur mikill, skeggöld, skalmöld, skildir er klopnir, vindöld, vargöld, áðu veröld steypist. So stories I've described as being a sort of a map of not only landscape, it tells you where things happen, it gives a new dimension to the landscape, it turns it from being a geological happening to something that's got history, that's got background, that's got different dimensions to it. It's a bit like a map being placed on top of the landscape.
From Mother's Blood, Sister Songs, the lyric feature on Sunday. And closer to home, Ella McSweeney went walkabout with Tina Claffey on Killaun Bog outside Birr, County Offaly for Countrywide. And it's when they step off the wooden walkway onto the bog itself that we get properly immersed in the land.
Squelchy, squirchy. Like a big wet mattress standing on it. Your feet kind of sink in, don't they? Bits of ice there. Oh, that crunch. Satisfying. Sorry, we went a little bit off the beaten track there. And if we stop for 1 second, I've spent probably more time than I should with a microphone on a bog. and there's a peculiar type of silence when you record on a bog.
There is a quality of silence, and actually, there's lots of other sounds. After a while, once you attune to your surroundings, you'll hear the birds. I'm just listening there. I even did a woodcock survey during the summer and discovered that there are actually woodcock here, which are really, really rare. They have a weird kind of almost electronic sound. At dusk, the males would fly low over the trees on the lookout for females, and then they'd make that lovely sound. So I've spotted 4 of them, so I was really, really delighted.
I often think that bogs are like capital cities when it comes to nature. They're just so populated.
The whole thing is alive. What you're walking on is alive.
And Tina Claffey told how the bog's treasures had revealed themselves.
I used to live in Africa, in Botswana, in southern Africa. And I lived there for almost 9 years. I'm a professional nature photographer. That's what I was doing in Africa. I was working with a guy doing flamingo research. So I was thrust into a world of nature, like living my own Attenborough movie, to be honest. as you can imagine, when I came back to Ireland after living in that wilderness, when I came back to Ireland, I was like, what am I doing back here? I missed everything about being in the wilderness. In 2011, I happened to go on a walk with John Feehan, who is a botanist and ecologist, and he brought a small group of us out here to this very bog, to Cologne Bog. He gave each of us a little magnifying glass. It really was an amazing moment for me, because I realised that here we were walking on a wilderness with just as much tangibility as the Kalahari or the Okavango Delta, teeming with life. I went back to the bog. I went back to this bog the very next day because I was so inspired by the walk.
So you went from these huge expansive places in Africa to a bog in Offaly where you were on your hands and knees into the world of the tiny.
Exactly, into the world of lichens and mosses and dragonflies and all sorts of amazing species that occur on the bog.
That is so beautiful. It would make you want to throw on the wellies and go out for a walk. Ella McSweeney and Tina Claffey has heard on Countrywide. Well, we're almost at a finish here on Playback, but it's been a very sad week for radio and for radio listeners. But let's finish with two clips of Marion Finucane. One from Morning Ireland, it's The Late Late Show, with Pat Kenny suggesting that she is both an everywoman and a pioneer. And then from The Tuberty Show, we'll hear Marion Finucane introducing a favourite song.
A series of programmes, the most recent being the Marion Finucane Show, before that Liveland Women Today. Did you feel like you were a women's icon?
No.
I mean, when you were doing the programmes, did you feel like you were...
No, I did not.
Every woman, as it were.
You must be joking. No. Do you feel as if you're every man? No, you can never take yourself too seriously.
Yeah, but at the same time, the kind of things that were going on in your programmes, women's issues, you know, needed to be addressed in a way that some don't need to be addressed now, although there are still some that radically need addressing. But did you feel like that you were being a pioneer in any way? Or?
I'll tell you what I felt like. We had great fun. We really did. Claire Dignan was the series producer, Betty Purcell, Patrick Farrey, a lot of them are still very close friends of mine. And there was that feeling that, you know, we'd give it a lash and we were forever in trouble. And that added to it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was great.
Hello there. I'm Marion Finucane. Being asked for your favourite piece of music is like being asked, what's your favourite book? Because your favourite book changes, and I think your favourite music changes depending on the time of day, depending on the mood, depending on who you're with. So I just decided I'd go for an old favourite as I started to emerge into my real life, so to speak, and I have chosen Luke Kelly and Raglan Road.
On Raglan Road of an autumn day, I saw her first and knew that her dark hair would weave a snare that I might one day rue. I saw the danger and I passed along the enchanted way, and I said, let grief be a fallen leaf at the dawning of the day.
That's it for this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
In November, we trip lightly.